Welcome to Geopolitics Decanted. I'm Dmitry Alperovich, chairman of Silverado Policy Accelerator, a geopolitics think tank in Washington, D.C. Today, I'm talking to my friend Sergei Radchenko, one of Cold War's preeminent historians and who, like me, has a book coming out very shortly called To Run the World, The Kremlin's Cold War Bid for Global Power. My own book is coming out on April 30th, really just days away now, and is about the new Cold War, or Cold War Roman numeral II, as I call it, and it's called World on the Brink, How America Can Be China in the Race for the 21st Century. Both books, I should say, are now available for orders from Amazon and all your favorite bookstores and in various formats, hardcover, Kindle, audiobook, so please consider buying them. Sergei, welcome to the show.
Dmitry, great to be on the show with you.
Absolutely. So let's start with your book. And one of the things that I find so fascinating about your book is that you write it very much from the perspective of the other side. There's been obviously numerous books that have been written about the Cold War or Cold War I history, but you've actually been able to access documents that have just recently been declassified from the former Soviet Union that gives you insights into the thinking of the Soviet leadership as opposed to the guessing of what they were thinking that you've had from most historians up to this point. How did you get access to these documents?
So that's a great question. Of course, it's not just the Soviet leaders, but also, and this is another point of the book that I like to advertise, also the Chinese leaders. Because for a time, Chinese archives were kind of open, a kind of means that you could sort of get in and get some documents from there if you knew who to talk to. But then Xi Jinping, seeing history as evidently a sensitive subject, cracked down. And now those materials that I worked with in China while I was there for 4 years are no longer available to historians. And of course, those materials in Russia that I worked with that were declassified and were available, they're still there, but nobody can go there. Even I cannot go there because I worry about being arrested. So it is a kind of interesting moment now. I mean, I collected all those materials over the years, took 10 years to write the book, used this absolute, you know, treasure trove of stuff to really analyze Soviet and Chinese decision-making during the Cold War, almost like, you know, like a doctor in a room sitting with patients. Because when you have the quantity of materials, it turns into quality, and you really get to understand what kind of people they were and what they obsessed over, what they dreamed about, what ambitions they had, but ultimately, you know, what fears they had. So that was a very interesting experience for me.
And one of the things you do is you debunk a number of myths that we've had about this first Cold War. One of the greatest, I think, is one you've already publicized as an excerpt, I guess, with a co-author, Vladislav Zubok, who is also another Cold War historian. You published a foreign affairs piece last year on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And you talked about the decision-making from the Soviet perspective of what led to that crisis, the buildup of missiles and the decision to put nuclear weapons on Cuba. And you write that one of the major causes of it was actually not Khrushchev's arrogance and feeling that America was weak, but the fear that he had that America was too strong and that America was too belligerent, and that the lesson that he had learned from the Bay of Pigs fiasco, right? This incident that was right at the beginning of the Kennedy administration in April of 1961, where CIA-armed Cuban dissidents attempted a coup on Cuba, got slaughtered, and was a terrible crisis for the Kennedy administration that they barely recovered from politically. The lesson that Khrushchev took from that was not that America had just made a catastrophic mistake, but that they were intent on taking Cuba and that they would try it again, right? I mean, complete misunderstanding of American politics to think that after such a catastrophe that Kennedy would try something like this again, but that the decision to put nuclear weapons on Cuba was seen as a deterrent against future attempts to invade. Isn't that right?
Exactly. And so this is one of the reasons, I think, because I sort of weave together this complicated narrative about why Khrushchev made this decision. And you can really parcel this out and you can say, well, there were strategic reasons, for example. That's what the Americans used to think, that the Soviets felt that they were weak in terms of their nuclear capability. So they had to build up in Cuba in order to compensate for the problems with their ICBMs that they had. The Soviets had intercontinental ballistic missiles. They had very few of them, right? So I probe that question, and what I determined was that it wasn't really this, because Khrushchev did not want to fight a nuclear war. In the end, nuclear balance wasn't even that important to him. What mattered to him in terms of thinking where he stood vis-a-vis the Americans in terms of the missiles, was the feeling that he had that he was being treated unequally, because the Americans had missiles in Turkey and he did not have missiles anywhere close to America. So he was like, well, how's that? You know, that's not fair. I'm a great leader of a great country. If the Americans are allowed to do this, I should be allowed to do this. So that's one reason. The other is what you alluded to, i.e. he really was just paranoid about American invasion of Cuba. He thought it was imminent, and he thought one way of to stop that was to put missiles in Cuba. But the question that I ask in the book, and that's actually fascinating aspect that a lot of historians haven't really looked into in any detail, is why he was so worried about losing Cuba. And what I determined is that it was for reasons of credibility. And, you know, this is something that would make sense if we're thinking about the Cold War from the American perspective, because we're always thinking in terms of credibility. Will America lose credibility here or there? But we don't think about the other side also thinking in those terms. So Khrushchev was absolutely convinced that if he lost Cuba to an American administration, he would lose his credibility. And whose credibility, in whose eyes? You know, that is the question. And the answer to this is China. And that's where China comes into the story of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is sort of unusual because, if you think about the Cuban Missile Crisis, China doesn't really figure there. But in my story, it figures big time because Khrushchev was obsessed with China. And actually, throughout the Cold War, Soviet leaders were trying to either impress the Chinese or deter the Chinese. They were constantly looking over their shoulder to see what the Chinese were thinking about their actions.
You know, the other fascinating aspect of this whole episode is the failure to appreciate the information that was undoubtedly being collected by Soviet intelligence, because we now know that they had numerous assets inside the U.S. intelligence community at that time. They were obviously had a number of KGB residentura based here in the United States. So certainly those people, I imagine, were writing reports back saying that Bay of Pigs was a huge fiasco for Kennedy. Kennedy is much weakened from this. And I guess Khrushchev was ignoring all of those reports and deciding to do intelligence analysis on his own and figuring that if Kennedy tried once, he would try it again.
Well, intelligence in Soviet decision-making was always an interesting story. The Soviets, as you say, Dmitry, had very good assets around the world. It depended really on the time. And actually, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think in the end, ultimately, intelligence played a positive role in the sense that the Soviet resident in Washington actually played a role in the back channel to the Americans and passing information back and forth that helped lead towards a resolution of the crisis. But in other instances, it played a kind of funny role. And one example that I would want to give you, which is very interesting, and I talk about it in the book, relates to the Korean War. That's actually one of the smoking guns of the book, because historians rarely have an opportunity to kind of say, look, here's a smoking gun that changes our interpretation of what happened. Well, in the Korean War, it turns out that intelligence played a key role in the decision by Stalin to authorize the Korean War. And how did it happen? How do we know what happened? Basically, in 1956, so the 3 years after Stalin died, in 1956, Anastas Mikoyan, who was Khrushchev's sidekick, one of Stalin's close lieutenants, he traveled to China. He met with Mao Zedong and the Eighth Party Congress, the Chinese Communist Party, had a conversation with Mao Zedong. And Mao Zedong asked him point blank. He said, why did you authorize the invasion of South Korea? Because, of course, Stalin did this, right? Stalin authorized this. Without this authorization, Kim Il-sung of North Korea would have never invaded South Korea. And Mikoyan answered this question, would you believe it? He answered this question. Our intelligence intercepted American cables that suggested that the United States would not fight for South Korea. And so we decided that the risk was worth taking. So that is a super interesting story because it shows how intercepting intelligence, so they got something from the intelligence channels. They thought it was convincing because it came from intelligence, but ultimately, of course, it misled them into believing that there would be no American response. And in the end, there was an American response, and the whole little affair of the Korean War turned into bloody, protracted quagmire that lasted for 3 years.
So many people died because of an intelligence intercept that misled them.
Exactly. Stalin was very cautious. I don't think he would have authorized the invasion of South Korea if he thought that there was a likely American response. He always was looking out over his... He was kind of very cautious looking at what American response would be in China, in Korea. If it looked like the Americans were going to react with force, he would back off. I mean, really, George Kennan got him right? George Kennan, his long telegram, he said, Soviet power is not like that of Hitlerite Germany. It is very opportunistic. I'm misquoting, of course, here, I'm summarizing it, but he said, when faced with force, it tends to retract and seek other opportunities. And that's exactly, what is the impervious to the logic of reason, it's highly sensitive to the logic of force. Now, that's the actual quote. I remember it now. Kennan was right, I think, on this particular issue, i.e. that basically Stalin was very, very, very opportunistic. Perhaps that's an interesting historical lesson that could have relevance for the present day.
Let me ask you one more question about the Cuban Missile Crisis, because here in America, it is viewed essentially as the U.S. victory, that we got the Soviets to back down, we avoided nuclear crisis, it was
the other side blinked, etc.
Yes, that and defining moment of the Kennedy presidency, right? How was it viewed by Khrushchev? Because he did get a tangible victory here in the sense that the Americans secretly agreed to pull back the missiles from Turkey. Was it seen as a victory or was it seen as a defeat? And obviously later on it likely contributed to the ouster of Khrushchev. But by himself at the time, did he see it as a win?
So he tried to spin it as a win. And what we have, and Khrushchev was a fascinating person. He never read a lot and he never wrote a lot, but he liked to just rant. And he had stenographers or, note takers around him who would be taking down his various rants. So we have his rants on the subject of the Cuban Missile Crisis and et cetera. And so we have those rants for October 27 or October 28. Those were the hottest days. What he was really concerned about was that there would be nuclear war. He really thought that it was very close. What really freaked him out was Castro suggesting a preemptive strike against the United States. So Castro passed through the Soviet representative in Cuba, passed a message to Khrushchev in which he said, the hour has come, this is not a pleasant step, but it should be taken or something like that. Khrushchev read this message. He was just, oh my God, this guy is crazy. What is he trying to drag us into a nuclear war? So he wrote, he sent a bunch of messages to Castro saying, look, this is a victory. We have extracted a promise from the United States not to invade Cuba. And this was a public promise, right? We extracted a promise and he was selling this to Castro. Of course, Castro did not buy it. Castro was absolutely outraged and the Soviet-Cuban relationship just plunged to unseen lows for months and months and months. But then there was, of course, the secret deal of taking the missiles out of Turkey, which nobody knew about except Khrushchev's own colleagues. So he was trying to sell that to his own colleagues saying, look, this is actually a victory. But I think he knew that it wasn't really a victory. And especially in the month after the Cuban Missile Crisis, he became extremely sensitive to Chinese criticism because the Chinese unleashed this propaganda saying the Soviets sold out Cuba. Yeah, blah, 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 and Khrushchev was just, he was livid. He was sending these letters to Castro saying, how can you, do not believe what the Chinese say. They're slandering us, this is, et cetera, et cetera. And as you say, in the end, although Khrushchev was mainly ousted for domestic reasons, i.e. he was, his bureaucratic restructuring and personality cult pissed off his colleagues, in the end, Cuba did play a role because then it was raised as a criticism directed against him that he brought the country to the brink of war and effectively lost in terms of his standing. So I think on balance, I think it's probably fair to say that the United States won in this particular confrontation. But I would say, I would add a little thing here to just to say, look, I think we all won, i.e. it was actually pretty close. I think it was probably the closest the world came to an actual nuclear confrontation. So if it happened, then, you know, could anybody win in that kind of war? Probably not. So from that perspective, Khrushchev also won.
So let's connect our two books, because I think they're quite complementary. You write about the Cold War I, I write about Cold War II with China. And one of the things that actually surprised me, believe it or not, Sergei, as I was researching this book, is the level of similarities that we have between the two conflicts. I mean, I came into it with a conviction that we were certainly in a Cold War, but I thought that there were more differences than there really ended up being, particularly closely comparing the two confrontations. And I just want to go through a few of them and get your reaction. But just like in the first Cold War, we have a global competition for supremacy around the world. The two powers, the United States and China, are clearly trying to win allies, trying to convince others of the superiority of their systems, trying to spread influence around the world, not just in the region itself, but really globally. You have preparations for war that are taking place. Both militaries are gearing up for a devastating conflict. You have an arms race going on. You know, one of the defining moments, of course, of the defining features of the first Cold War was a nuclear and a conventional arms race. We have the same scenarios playing out now on the nuclear front. We have a massive Chinese buildup of warheads and missile silos and really expanding their nuclear triad of delivery systems and a huge conventional arms race as well in the naval sphere, missiles, and so forth. You have a space race, a competition to try to get to the moon and who gets there first. And really, in all aspects of space, you have a great degree of competition that, again, defined Cold War I. You have economic warfare, both in terms of export controls and some sanctions and attempts to impact each other's economic systems and massive amounts of economic espionage, which I write in the book was actually characteristic of the first Cold War. Today, it's mostly done through cyber, but in the original Cold War, it was done through economic espionage means conducted by the KGB, the so-called Line X, but also by American and British and German industrials going over to the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s and transferring massive amounts of intellectual property to the Soviet Union. And even after World War II, I write this episode, you mentioned Mikoyan. He was a trade minister under Stalin, and he had gone to Stalin in 1946 after the Churchill speech in Missouri talking about the Iron Curtain, after, you know, there's broad awareness that we are in a Cold War confrontation with the Soviet Union. He goes to Stalin and says, we're trying to build the first mass-produced MiG-15 jet fighter that would later be used in Korea. And he says, we're having problems with the engine reliability, and we would like your permission to approach the British to license the Rolls-Royce engines. And Stalin incredulously says, what fool is going to sell you their secrets? But, you know, no harm in trying, give it a shot. And they do so, and the Labour government that had just been elected in the UK agrees to sell them the Rolls-Royce engines. They customize it for the MiG-15 jet fighter. And a few years later in the Korean War, those jet fighters flown by both North Korean and Soviet pilots are responsible for shooting down over 160 American pilots over Korea. Just a remarkable element of arming the enemy that plays out in this confrontation with China as well. And beyond that, you have a major regional flashpoint, Taiwan, in this case, West Berlin, for much of the early Cold War history. And obviously, Cuba during that 1962 period. You have a scramble for bases like you had in Cold War I, where, you know, America obviously is trying to shore up its bases in the region. We're going back into the Philippines. We're expanding in Japan. China is doing the same thing in Pakistan and Cambodia, even as far away as Africa and Djibouti. You have an espionage war that characterized the Cold War. So on virtually every element of this confrontation, it is so remarkably similar to what we face in a Cold War. I was just absolutely struck going through the research and putting together this book, how similar the two conflicts are. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I think the tide also has shifted. The tide has turned in terms of our interpretation of the present and where we are in our relationship with Russia and China. Now, when first proper post-Cold War histories of the Cold War appeared in the 1990s, we were in a very different moment. I mean, at that time, remember, history was supposed to have ended and there was euphoria. There's going to be freedom and democracy and economic prosperity for all. Russia was our big friend. China, although they had their Tiananmen moment in 1989, was also going in the direction of capitalism and prosperity. And here we are 30 years later in a state of, well, we've got a hot war, which could be characterized as perhaps even a proxy war in Europe. We have a confrontation along all of those dimensions that you mentioned with China: economic, political, strategic, geopolitical. All of those things are in place. And then you start comparing the present moment to the Cold War. And indeed, you see that the 30-year interwar period, as probably we should call it now, is actually an exception rather than the rule. And it seems that the default state of international politics, really since the invention of nuclear weapons, perhaps, is a Cold War of some kind or another. That's a really sad realization, but I think it reflects reality. And there are lots of parallels. When I was reading your book, I mean, one of the things that you say about espionage, I think, was very, very interesting. That you basically say that, well, in the future, when historians write about the Second Cold War, what is going to be, what will they see as the starting point? And you refer to the case of indictments against Chinese PLA officers who were stealing intellectual property from American companies. And that when I was reading that, I was thinking actually of a different moment in the early Cold War back in the 1940s how did the Americans really realize that they were in a state of the Cold War? Actually, it had everything to do. It wasn't even, Churchill's Fulton speech. It was really the arrest, or not arrest, the defection of the Soviet cipher clerk at the Ottawa embassy, Igor Guzenko, who then revealed that the Soviets had assembled a gigantic espionage machine in the United States, including atomic espionage. And of course, that sort of developed into a big scandal at that time. But you could almost you can almost date the Cold War to that particular moment, certainly in the American imagination. It became absolutely clear that the Soviets, they're out to get us. Just as now we can say, well, here the Chinese, they were out to get us while they were, spying on us while we were thinking that they were, building a productive chimerica relationship. So there are indeed very interesting parallels here. And of course, the key aspect is which I think makes for perfect comparison between the two periods, is the presence of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons is what made the Cold War so distinct. Some people today sort of go back to the First World War and say, well, what we have today is much more similar to great power competition before the First World War. I don't buy this. Why don't I buy this? Because there is, before the First World War, the nuclear element was not there. Today, there is a nuclear element. It imposes certain logic on our competition, our confrontation with Russia, with China, i.e., this is why we're, putting so much effort in deterrence. That is why we have competition in other realms. That is why we end up with proxy wars, because the idea of a direct conventional war between two nuclear powers is unthinkable. And so that is where, it's unthinkable. It could still happen, of course. It could still happen. That's a worrying thing. So I think you're right in making this comparison. And I can just say that if you asked almost any historian 20 years ago or even 10 years ago whether this comparison makes sense, you would get 100 arguments against this. You would say, oh, no, the Cold War was a distinct, very unique, very different thing because it was about ideology, or it was about something else. Today, I think this comparison makes much more sense.
Yeah, and the ideology is present in this conflict as well. It may not be capitalism versus communism, but certainly authoritarianism versus democracy. Even, you know, President Biden talks a lot about that. But, you know, one thing I wonder, and I'm curious how you think about this, I wonder if this conflict is actually more dangerous and more likely to bring us into a hot war. And, you know, that's one of the premises in the book. I talk about how we are truly a world on the brink. And I wonder if one of the stabilizing factors in Cold War I and even in the Cuban Missile Crisis, as you write, is that you had this generation of leaders throughout most of the Cold War, certainly on the Soviet side and mostly even on the American side, that had gone through the horrors of World War II. Stalin, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, right into the 1980s, right, that knew what the horror of terrible, terrible war, not even a nuclear one, but a conventional one, was like. Soviet Union, of course, lost tens of millions of its citizens during that conflict. And as you said, Khrushchev did not want a nuclear war. He knew the consequences of this. But the leadership we have today, both in America and in China, has not gone through anything of that sort. I mean, they've read the history books and seen the movies, but it's not quite the same as experiencing it. And Xi Jinping, of course, has not gone through any wars at all. So do you think that we have a less constrained leadership that may not be as afraid of a catastrophic war as the leadership that we had throughout Cold War I?
I mean, I think that's a hugely important question. I mean, you touch on something that is so important for understanding the direction of international politics, personal experiences of the leaders. And that is, you know, that's something that historians sometimes are criticized for. Well, why are you here looking so much into, you know, leaders, this great men, et cetera, and they're mostly just men, right? Who, and their decision making, why aren't you looking into social conditions or something else, right? Well, that's because they matter. They are, as Bush said, the deciders, right? They make those decisions. What they experienced in their life affects these decisions. And you referred to Soviet leaders, and you're exactly right. Khrushchev lost a son in the Second World War. Khrushchev was at Stalingrad. And actually, I begin my book with, you know, by recounting how Khrushchev, in his memoirs, he talks about, somewhere he talks about seeing corpses of Germans being burned at Stalingrad, because there were so many corpses, they would pile them, they would put some wood between them, and then, you know, they would set them on a light, and he said it was an absolutely horrible sight. Now, Brezhnev, the next Soviet leader, he also was in the Second World War. In fact, he was at Novorossiysk, and that's where he sustained an injury. He fell off the boat or was thrown off the boat or something happened there. You know, Andropov was not perhaps directly involved, but he directed a guerrilla movement. And even Mikhail Gorbachev, as a youngster growing up in Stavropol, saw the consequences of war because the area where he lived was occupied by the Germans. And then, you know, he actually describes that in his memoirs. He says that, you know, we saw those corpses and it was so horrible, et cetera, et cetera. So you have a whole generation that was really defined, also on the American side, you know, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, JFK, he had a direct experience of the Second World War. He was a commander on a boat, which was obviously sunk, and, you know, experienced trauma as a result. And so that really impacts the way people think. You look at Putin, you know, look at Xi Jinping. These people, what did they experience? You know, Putin's probably most defining experience was the collapse of the USSR and the humiliation that he experienced as a result of that. For Xi Jinping, I would argue, was the Cultural Revolution. He's the last Chinese leader, I think, that would have, you know, who would have had that experience of political violence during the Cultural Revolution. But they never experienced a war, and that makes you really worried.
Our mutual friend Neil Ferguson, another historian, recently wrote a piece in, I think, Foreign Affairs and later Bloomberg, that talks about the detente policy. He's, of course, a biographer of Henry Kissinger, And he writes that the current Biden administration policy of, in some ways, having an aggressive policy of confrontation with China on certain elements of particularly technological competition is misguided, and that they should learn the from Kissinger and attempt a new detente that Kissinger was able to create in the 1970s. One of the things I argue, I'm curious for your thoughts on this, is that the detente of the 1970s with the Soviet Union could not have happened had you not had the building of the Berlin Wall. In fact, I cite this episode in the book that in 1961, you also had an incredibly dangerous moment, perhaps almost as dangerous as a Cuban Missile Crisis, maybe even more so in some ways, when throughout that summer, Kennedy was convinced that Khrushchev was going to invade West Berlin, and he went on television and warned Americans that we were going to fight for West Berlin and to prepare for potential nuclear war. That's where the duck and cover drills came from in the United States, the building of bomb shelters and the like. That summer was incredibly, incredibly tense. And in August of that year, he's told that these Germans are building the wall, and he celebrates. He says, thank God, they're building the wall. That means they're not invading. And I wonder if that is the turning point for the first Cold War, where Americans realize that maybe Soviets are not just expansionists, or they're curtailing their expansionist ambitions in many ways, certainly in Europe, and they're happy to try to keep what they've got and encircle it in this Iron Curtain. And once you had a stabilization of this confrontation in Europe, which was the place where you really had the potential of a Soviet-United States war that could have generated into a nuclear conflict, you had the opportunity to create a detente. Once you stepped back from the brink, you had to, the opportunity to engage that Kissinger and Nixon took advantage of in the 1970s. And what I write in my book is that if we manage to deter conflict over Taiwan, which is another one of those flashpoints that defines this Cold War II confrontation, that we might be able to do what Neil describes, which is create a detente with China and sort of agree on to disagree, but compete in a much less dangerous way. But you have to have that deterrent effect. You have to pull back from the threat of war that I fear is coming and could come in just as little as 4 or 5 years from now. And without that, detente is not possible. Do you agree with me?
So I agree and disagree in some ways in terms of this comparison. So first of all, on the Berlin Wall, I think you're exactly right. Berlin Wall was a moment that actually made the hot war between the two superpowers less likely. It stabilized the Cold War, and it solved the problem for Khrushchev, because Khrushchev's main problem was that there were people escaping, you know, voting with their feet, and they were escaped by walking across the street. They were escaping from the socialist paradise, and you know, you couldn't do that. You had to plug this hole. So he ordered the construction of the Berlin Wall, although his ideal scenario was basically to smoke the Americans out of Berlin, but he was worried about a nuclear war. He actually thought that the chances of a nuclear war over West Berlin were 5%, but when push came to shove, 5% was much too high. You know, it's sort of like it's if you're playing with the fate of civilization, you know, if you're a gambler in a casino, say 5% or 95% chance of winning, I'll gamble my whole salary and my whole fortune, you know. But if you're playing with the fate of civilization, then 5% ultimately proved too high for Khrushchev. He backed off, he built the wall. Now, there was, of course, the Checkpoint Charlie moment, the confrontation with the tanks that was sort of later in October 1961 that also could have resulted in a nuclear war. But fortunately, at that time, the Soviets and the Americans found enough sense to use a back channel to disengage from that. So, and afterwards, things kind of became more or less stable, and detente became possible, but also for some other reasons. And the reasons were on the Soviet side. On the American side, obviously, the Vietnam War was just drawing such a huge, huge resources from the Americans, and they were thinking of how to get the hell out of there, and they thought maybe detente would actually help them achieve that. On the Soviet side, they had been building nuclear arsenal to a point where they thought they were basically equal or even superior to the United States. And so they felt a little bit safer in this regard. They were interested in developing economic ties, especially with the Europeans. And in fact, the origins of the Entente were very much in Europe in the mid-1960s, Soviet engagement with De Gaulle's France, then, of course, with Willy Brandt in West Germany after the after SPD came to power after September 1969. But really, and this is interesting, I think one of the key reasons for the Entente was that the Soviets were preoccupied with a real threat on their eastern frontier, because in March 1969, they had basically a war with China. Now, they don't call it a war, it's a border conflict over Damansky, Jinbao Dao, you know, but it was pretty serious. So lots of people died. And the Soviets were hinting at a nuclear strike against China, etc. So they were absolutely obsessed with the Chinese threat. They were worried about it. And taking against that backdrop of the Chinese threat, the Americans appeared less menacing. So they were very keen at that point to invite Nixon. So Nixon came in May 1972. And the rest is history. So we had this detente, which interestingly, and I argue that in the book, was an interesting condition, in the sense that it did not really, I mean, the Soviets craved it because they wanted to feel equal to the United States. They wanted to run the world together with the United States, hence the title of my book. That's actually a quote from Brezhnev. But the problem was that it was unstable. It was unstable. So, for example, in the Middle East, they were screwed by Kissinger. They lost out. And the moment that there was an opportunity to stab the Americans in the back, they would do that. They would do that with gusto. They did that in Africa. They were very happy that America was defeated in Vietnam. And that, you know, obviously by 1975, Vietnam was unified under the communists. And so all of which is to say that the Entente was a kind of an unstable process in the Cold War. And I struggled with what to make out of this, because the Cold War continued, even as the Entente kind of rose and fell. And I think the Entente was fundamentally unstable. Why is that? Because fundamentally, the Soviet-American relationship was competitive. And you could really just maybe stabilize it, but you cannot resolve this competition. One or the other side had to win. Ultimately, of course, America won. So if you project that over to the Chinese example today, then I would say that there's obviously, you know, possibility that the Chinese are craving recognition, much as the Soviets were craving recognition in the early 1970s for some kind of relationship equals with the United States. You know, what they call that? They call it the two great power relationship. The Chinese analysts call this that.
I mean, you could argue that the detente lasted, what, maybe 7 years at the most, from 72 to 79 with the invasion of Afghanistan, right?
I would think it was dead even before that in many ways. It was certainly on the rocks. I think, you know, one interesting thing about detente which made it possible was the personal relationship between Nixon and Brezhnev, because Brezhnev loved Nixon. He was so heartbroken over Watergate. He was like, you know, and that's actually, I've got a funny anecdote in my book about how the Soviets were trying to find compromise on Nixon's enemies. One of Brezhnev's aides wrote to Andropov saying, you know, can we find something? Obviously, the whole Watergate business is an effort to undermine the Entente. Can we find something to help Nixon? Andropov responds saying, well, we have only limited opportunities. We'll try to find something. But obviously, in the end, Nixon was, you know, had to resign. And taking this personal relationship out of it, you know, Brezhnev never developed a good relationship with Ford. Moreover, by 1974-75, Brezhnev was sort of on his way out, in the sense, in the mental sense, right? He did not die until 1982, but mentally he was on his way out. And so you kind of lost this personal aspect of this. So detente was kind of declining very quickly, I think, after 74 already. So it was a very short period.
You know, the other major point I make in the book is that in both conflicts, U.S. had enormous advantages that over Soviet Union in Cold War I, over China in Cold War II, that both of those countries are actually very fundamentally weak. You know, it is America that has the world's greatest economy, the world's greatest military, the innovation engine, relative security of the two oceans, a navy that is able to project power across the entire world. And, you know, when I look at China today, I see very concerning trend lines concerning for them, with their economy stagnating, them reaching the middle income trap that they probably will not be able to escape, population collapse that is going to come later in the century, that is going to be unlike anything we have seen in human history, going from about 1.4 billion people today to maybe as few as 550 million by the end of the century. That's going to just have dramatic implications on their whole society, both economically as well as culturally and psychologically, but also geographically. They're completely contained. And that's one of the reasons why I think that Taiwan is so important to them, not just to Xi personally, and I think it is in terms of his attempt to portray him as the one that is more powerful and capable than Mao, and the one thing that Mao could never do, which is take Taiwan. But also, if you look at the geography, and I have this map in the book where from Chinese perspective, you look out at the world and you're completely contained by American military bases and American partners, right? From South Korean Peninsula with American troops there to the Japanese islands with American troops there to Taiwan, which they see as an outpost of America, to the Philippines, where we once again are deploying troops. If you are the Chinese military, if you're to the Chinese Navy and you're trying to project global power, you have to go through these choke points between the islands of the first island chain. And they're essentially today controlled by U.S. Navy and our partners. So if you want to be a great power, you can't allow that to happen. And of course, Taiwan is the anchor point in that first island chain, that if they controlled it, they would be able to project power across the Western Pacific and beyond, and really set the rules of the game, I argue, in that region and push America out. But without that, they're fundamentally weak. Geopolitically, economically, even militarily, they're strong, of course, in their backyard. But, you know.
Also, in terms of ideas, you know, that is an underappreciated aspect.
Absolutely. So, you know, my argument is that just like in Cold War I, if we manage to deter conflict and we wait them out, we will make sure that the century, like the last one, remains an American century. Do you fundamentally buy that?
I think I buy that at many levels. I mean, first of all, I agree with you completely. During the Cold War, the first Cold War, the United States was clearly the superpower. The Soviet Union, it was kind of, as I mentioned, by the late 1960s, it was getting up there in terms of its just sheer capacity to destroy militarily the world with their nuclear weapons. And they also had high conventional capabilities, but in economic terms, they were really not doing particularly well, and their ideology became stale very, very quickly. And nobody, even when communist regimes were turning communist in Africa in the 1970s, were they buying Soviet ideology? Not really. They were buying Soviet weapons. You know, they were getting Soviet aid, and that's what led them to embrace Moscow. So, in the end, the Soviet Union proved to be a giant of clay. And it became clear. It wasn't clear in the 70s. It seemed that America was declining. You had the oil crisis. You had stagflation. You had Vietnam. You withdrawal from Vietnam. And so it looked all kind of bad. But then by the 1980s, look what happened. America bounced back, the Soviet Union fell apart, and all kind of just happened overnight. So I think belief in oneself is very important here. I think, as you said, America has so many advantages. If you look at China today, who are China's friends? Is it Russia? Maybe Russia is an important partner. I mean, their relationship is not even an alliance. You know, it's an alignment. They all look after their own interests. Yes, their interests overlap in many areas of the world. But then China also faces nations that could potentially be very hostile to it, very close nearby. You know, the Japanese, for example, Vietnam. How's India looking into
I write about this in the book. China has border disputes with every single one of its neighbors. There's not one that they don't have a dispute with.
Well, of course, historically, they've had border conflicts with India. They had border conflicts with Russia. They even fought a border conflict with North Korea in 1969, which is a small little thing that few people know about. And of course, Vietnam and China weren't getting along very well at all. And in fact, in 1979, China invaded Vietnam. So China is surrounded by countries that are basically pretty hostile towards China. And America, in this regard, is actually in a much better position, globally and economically, in so many respects.
Do you think that when you compare the two powers in the two Cold Wars, Soviet Union and China, that Soviet Union was actually stronger? It had this alliance network. It had the Warsaw Pact. It had global influence, right? In Latin America and in Middle East, in Southeast Asia, it was deeply involved. And China, except for economic ties, is not really present. I mean, where are they in this conflict between Russia and Ukraine? Where are they in the conflicts in the Middle East? They're barely there, certainly nowhere near the level of engagement that the Soviet Union had around the world. And military power of Soviet Union had much greater power projections throughout much of the Cold War. Is China fundamentally even weaker than the Soviet Union?
I mean, I think it's a yes and no question, because in the sense of military alliances, the Soviet Union had the Warsaw Pact, which they controlled, and they used it very effectively. I mean, think about the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968. Well, that went just very quickly. It wasn't just the Soviet Union, it was also other Warsaw Pact countries. Their major weakness during the Cold War was China, because when China became a problem for the Soviet Union, that really drew down Soviet military. The border between China and the USSR became one of the most militarized in the world, and it really was a huge problem for them. So when they fixed this problem in the starting from the mid 1980s, that really was a big help. But economically, this is where it's kind of different. I think China does have a better economic base, frankly, than does the Soviet Union. In this sense, it's much more of a peer competitor to the United States economically than the Soviet Union ever was, because the Soviet Union, as you say, Dmitry, very rightly, was relying on American technologies and Western technologies, and in the end, even had to import grain, despite the fact that it had Ukraine, but it still wasn't enough. It had to import grain from the West. So it was,
but China is importing food and energy as well.
Sure, China is, but if in turn it's exporting stuff that others want to buy, whereas the Soviet Union was exporting stuff that nobody wanted to buy. There was a funny moment in 1980.
Except energy, right?
Well, energy, of course, they made Europe very dependent on Russian energy, and that this is something that began really in the late 1960s, early 1970s. They started building those pipelines. And the Americans at that time were telling the Europeans, saying, careful, you're taking all this energy from the USSR. The Germans were like, oh, fine, don't worry about it. That will actually, they'll be dependent on us because we're an important market. So obviously we see how that played out.
Last question for you, Sergey, which I think has enormous implications for this new Cold War as well. But do you think that America was always destined to win Cold War I because of the structural weaknesses in the Soviet Union?
I think so. And you know what? I think it's very interesting. Kennan, in his Long Telegram, people liked citing the Long Telegram for a variety of reasons, but few people actually read to the end of the Long Telegram. In the end of the Long Telegram, he has this interesting observation. He says, really, what we need to do is we need to contain Soviet power. We need to remember that we are fundamentally just a more attractive society. And if we invest in ourselves, if we believe in ourselves and we invest in ourselves and we build up our own resilience and our own society, our own economy, we are going to win this. And I think he was right. This is an observation that is underrated in many ways, because Kennan could see that this is not a natural state of things, that people crave freedom, that people cannot live in this, socialist paradise. It just wasn't the natural thing. And he was fundamentally right in the end, in the sense that the Soviet Union collapsed. Why? It collapsed due to internal contradictions. It collapsed because of its economic problems. It collapsed because people were just disillusioned with the official ideology. They thought it was complete BS, right? They were looking for other things. And so those internal weaknesses brought the Soviet Union down. And at the same time, the American society proved to be incredibly resilient, incredibly strong, despite the fact that during the Cold War, there were also problems. The race problems of the 1950s, 1960s, the Vietnam War protests, you know, all kinds of issues, economic decline and problems in the 1970s. And yet the United States was able to pull together and finally come around to win the Cold War for the West. And I think those things that made the United States so resilient and so capable during the Cold War, they remain. So I'm fundamentally optimistic about the West. And I'm speaking here as somebody who lived in China. You know, I lived in China for a number of years. And, you know, I'm not like one of those who sort of goes to China for 3 days and says, oh, look at those trains. They're so amazing. You know, China is going to rule the world. You know, there's some problems there. There's some serious problems inside the society, and you actually elaborated some of those problems. And I remain fundamentally optimistic. I think if we just focus on what matters here in the West, resilience, our infrastructure, our education, R&D, healthcare, those things that make us strong internally, that is what is going to make the world of a difference in this century.
Yeah, and that is really the theme of my book, that we have all the ingredients for winning this Cold War II, just as we won Cold War I. In many ways, the book is a huge nod to Kennan, and the strength of the American system and the attractiveness of it remains despite numerous problems that we have. And if you just look at our border, which certainly is incredibly problematic, but when you look at the people that are coming over that border today, so many of them are Chinese. And I can assure you there's no Americans that are trying to jump over the border into China from North Korea or elsewhere, right?
That's right. That's the thing, because America is an attractive society. But, you know, it is kind of interesting that in our dark times, we're both kind of optimistic.
Yeah, and we're going to end it on that note. So please check out our two books, Sergei's book, To Run the World, The Kremlin's Cold War Bid for Global Power, my own book, World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. Sergei, thank you so much.
Mitri, great conversation.